From Washington, VOA presents Issues in the News.
Welcome to Issues in the News. I'm your moderator, David Rennie, Washington Bureau Chief for The Economist. On the panel this week, Tom DeFrank, contributing editor to National Journal, and Dan Raviv, national correspondent for Israeli-based channel I-24 News. And here are the issues. The Islamic State extremist group suffered a major blow as American-backed forces captured Raqqa, a northern Syrian city that ISIS claimed as the capital of its so-called caliphate. America's two main allies in Iraq ended up in an armed standoff. Iraq's central government ignored American pleas and sent troops deep into territory held by Kurdish forces. With Donald Trump preparing for a long visit to Asia in November, reports say that aides to the US president disagree about whether he should stage a symbolic visit to the heavily fortified border between the two Koreas. President Trump continued to leave Republicans in Congress guessing as he offered confusing signals about such big issues as healthcare and taxes. Finally, legislators in the French-speaking Canadian region of Quebec banned users of public buses and other government services from wearing anything that covers their face, a move that critics say targets Muslims. So it's a busy week in the Middle East. Tom, we've had, I guess, if you're sitting in the White House Situation Room, it's been a roller coaster because there's been both good and bad news from that part of the world that was in the grip of ISIS, the Islamic State extremist group. Start with the good news in terms of the fight against ISIS. How big a deal is the fall of Raqqa?
I think symbolically it's a very big deal, David. This was, as you say, was the capital of what ISIS proclaimed as its caliphate. The town square there has become notorious as the site for many of the grislier beheadings and other executions of ISIS against innocent people, and it's another indicator that ISIS's territory is continuing to shrink. That doesn't mean global terrorism is going away, but ISIS's control of land has steadily over the last 2 years diminished. So that's the good news.
Dan, so Tom asks the very good question, what happens to Raqqa, but also what happens to ISIS after it, you know, loses this thing that made it stand out? You know, unlike any of the previous iterations, like Al-Qaeda in Iraq, it had a territory. At one point, it's sort of almost as large as Portugal.
Yeah.
Let's start with what happens to Raqqa, just very briefly, because it's such a kind of alphabet soup of different groups. Who captured Raqqa? Was it American soldiers, or was it American-backed soldiers, or actually were the Iranians also part of this?
It's not neat and tidy, but the American-backed SDF, the Syrian Democratic Forces, are given most of the credit for finally getting into Raqqa, pushing back the ISIS fighters. But they were leaving, of course. The real hope for years had been that if and when Raqqa and Mosul in Iraq could be recaptured by good guys, and of course in Syria we still don't know exactly who the good guys might be, that maybe the leaders of ISIS could be found, but they vanished. And what are they doing? I'm sure they're planning more terrorism. You mentioned the good news that the so-called capital of the caliphate has fallen, but the bad news is that with ISIS still active, still with a strong ideology, still with people who go on the internet and spread their ideas and their inspiration for violence all around the world, all of them still active, I think we could see ISIS strike more in European cities, and that may be one result of the ISIS defeats in the Middle East region itself.
Now, Tom, clearly that is in and of itself enough to worry about, and we saw even the head of the British Internal Security Service warning exactly of that, that we could see these, kind of metastasizing of the threat. Now they've lost their territory. Let's also look across the border from Syria into Iraq and head to the north of Iraq, where you had this region that was essentially pretty much an autonomous Kurdish region with its own capital, Erbil, and you'd have, you know, American leaders flying in directly to meet the Kurdish leaders there. And over the last several years, they had extended their territory very substantially, and they had taken areas full of oil fields and the city of Kirkuk and almost down to kind of Mosul and the Mosul Dam. Something seems to have gone pretty badly wrong in that relationship between the Kurdish Autonomous Region and the Iraqi central government. What's been going on?
Well, I think Iraq, the central government of Iraq, has become emboldened by the fall of Raqqa and by the desire to get their oil fields back from the Kurds. And obviously, there's never been a whole lot of love lost between the Kurds and the Iraqis, or the Turks for that matter, but that's another story. So I think the Iraqi government is wanting to retrieve its territory from Kurds, especially the oil fields. And this is a real complication for the U.S. because, as you noted, the United States government has backed both the Iraqi central government and the Kurds, who have been quite helpful in the effort to expel ISIS from Iraq, from Syria, and to diminish their hold on territory that they once had. And so it puts the United States in a real bind, and it's very unclear how this is going to sort out. But the Kurds aren't going to just unilaterally walk away from territory that they have held for a long time, and the Iraqis want their territory back.
But Tom and David, it almost sounded like, Tom, you're putting the blame for the latest flare-up mostly on the Iraqis wanting their oil fields back. Wasn't this instigated by the Kurds having that referendum where more than 9 out of 10 voters in Iraqi Kurdistan voted to break away, have an independent country? It's only natural for the central government in Baghdad to be annoyed, to say the least. And let's point out that the United States government did gently, kind of quietly, but still publicly, gave advice to the Kurds not to have the referendum, saying this is a very delicate time. Iraq is still fragile. Don't do it now. That seemed to be the event that really instigated this.
That's fair enough. The Kurds seem not to have been willing to leave well enough alone for the moment, and sensed an opening and took it. And as a result, everything is more complicated now than it was a couple of weeks ago.
And I think absolutely, Dan. You pointed out that the Kurds, there are Kurdish leaders now blaming, you know, each other, and there's a lot of finger pointing about whether they overreached. I think you can make the case absolutely that this referendum was an overreach. Well, I'm sure we will come back to that unhappy region many more times. But let's turn to another very complicated area, Asia. President Trump, who is not notoriously fond of foreign travel, is bracing himself, Dan, for a very long trip to Asia in November, almost 2 weeks, covering a huge amount of ground. I was actually talking to some people who worked on previous presidential trips to Asia for Presidents Bush and Obama, and they're sort of stunned that the Trump team are letting him take this long a trip. They don't know how anyone can sort of take that pace.
I know, but about the mileage. Did they say how many days it would be in total?
Yeah, I think isn't it 13 days
it's like
or something?
It's like 13 or so.
And yeah, he's covering a lot of countries, and that's brutal for anyone. But, you know, he's not a young man either. One of the things that has been bubbling around in the reporting this week here in Washington, Dan, is that when American presidents traditionally visit South Korea, major ally, of course, at any time, they pay the symbolic visit to the heavily fortified, much misnamed demilitarized zone between the two Koreas, and they stand there and they look kind of tough. And I know that Tom has been there with presidents, so we'll ask him to describe that. But what has been the reporting about the debate within the White House as to whether President Bush should do this trip?
Well, I've heard several opinions, and one of them is that it just plain wouldn't be safe at a time like this. You never know what the North Koreans might do. They might even take a shot from one of their snipers. Now, I don't believe that. You don't believe that. But, of course, the Secret Service is in the business of protecting the president from all sorts of unexpected possibilities. Then there are those who are more, well, political about it and wondering whether it's all going to look good, right? You can plan with Donald Trump to go to a place, to have an event, to meet with the Boy Scouts and give a speech, but you never know what he's going to say and if it might backfire in some way. And then on international politics, they wonder again what the world will think, what even our Asian partners will think of him going to the border and looking like he's a military chief. Now, he is the commander-in-chief. He clearly has threatened already in a speech at the United Nations Nations General Assembly, of all places, to destroy totally North Korea if necessary. So I think he's leaning toward the militant look.
And there's also South Korean politics at work here, Dan, isn't there? That we have a new government in South Korea that is not quite as saber-rattling as some others.
It favors dialogue, but of course the South Korean people have been seeing what's going on. And, well, there's the possibility that the Trump administration will actually think that we know what's good for them more than they know. And if the American president doesn't agree with South Korea's leader, then Trump's going to do it Trump's way.
And we'll have more in just a minute. This is Issues in the News, coming to you on the Voice of America in Washington. I'm your moderator, David Rennie, Washington Bureau Chief of The Economist, along with our panelists, Tom DeFrank, contributing editor to National Journal, and Dan Raviv, national correspondent for Israeli-based channel I-24 News. Issues in the News is available for free download on iTunes. Just click on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com. Listen to it, and then tell us what you think by taking a short survey on our Facebook page, Current Affairs, with Carol Castiel. Now, Dan has set up the fact that this is a very delicate moment in Korean relations and in America's relations with Korea. Tom, tell us about what a delicate place the DMZ is. Now, I think you and I have both been there. It is not like anywhere else on the face of the earth, even by Cold War standards. This is a very bizarre place with incredibly close physical proximity between South Korean American troops and North Korean troops. How does it work when an American president visits this Freedom's Frontier, as they call it on the southern side? You've been there with other presidents.
I've been there with two presidents and with a vice president, Al Gore. It's very isolated. It's heavily fortified. You see concertina wire every place. There are a couple of American base camps. The first time I went there, the second time I went there with President Reagan, it was called Camp Liberty Bell, but the name has been changed. I've forgotten it's been the name, but it was changed to honor the memory of a U.S. Army officer who was one of two officers killed in the demilitarized zone, trying to chop down a tree that was it hindered lines of sight, even after the North Koreans had agreed to let the Americans and South Koreans chop down this tree. They ignored that, and when this started, the North Koreans came and murdered two Americans.
So with the axe that he was using to trim the tree.
With an axe, yeah. Exactly right. And it is a hostile environment. And you if you are an important enough person, like a president or vice president or Secretary of State, Secretary of Defense, you can go from one of these base camps about a mile and a half up the road to observation posts where you can look right over into North Korea, where they've seem to have erected what I would call a Potemkin village. Not many people live there, if at all. There are huge North Korean flags, and there's noise from loudspeakers. This is where President Reagan famously looked over into the north and said, this village is as phony as their ideology, or something like that. It is made for television. And that's why I think that President Trump, who is a reality television pioneer, if you will, I'd be surprised if he passed up this opportunity. When there was a story in the Washington Post in the last few days saying that the administration is really torn, I thought that was a leak set up to make it look that President Trump was being heroic and bold going up there. Now, it is a dangerous place, and I know that the Secret Service is concerned about this, but I would be surprised if President Trump doesn't go to the DMZ. I'd be very surprised.
So we'll see the theater. Although I don't think presidents do. So the both times I've been from the north and the south side, and you have those huts either side that straddle the border. There are American huts, and then there are the blue huts from the North Korean side. And you can go in and you get to the line halfway across. Then you have the North Korean soldiers looking through the windows, kind of taking your photograph. My memory is American presidents don't go to those.
No, that would be
village.
Tempting fate for an American president to go to Panmunjom. I think maybe President-elect Eisenhower might have gone, but that was a very long time ago. No, American presidents do not go up there because you're you're right across the line looking at North Korean soldiers.
And we have a President Trump sort of making it into a personal kind of conflict with
Kim Jong-un, Rocket Man, as he, or Little Rocket Man, as he has said.
Little Rocket Man, yeah. Well, I have no doubt we'll be coming back to that Asia visit. He's going to China, a massively important visit, Japan, the Philippines, a series of summits. We're here in Washington. I suspect I've even said these words before, that there is uncertainty in Congress as the leaders of the Republican Party who control the whole of Congress, both chambers of Congress, and the Republican president who sits in the White House. Normally, if you control both chambers of Congress and the White House, that's a recipe for sitting down, getting out your agenda and working your way through it. Hasn't been happening quite as neatly as that. How has this week been? Has it been smooth sailing, Dan, in terms of the big agenda items? And I take the two biggest would be tax reform and health care. What to do about the legacy of the health law left behind by Barack Obama. Where are we this week?
Well, President Trump has been speaking about both those subjects. He claims that health reform will come back early in 2018. It'll come back. We're confident we have the votes. Details of what that plan would be, I don't want to bore the listeners, and it may change a lot, but he says basically huge amounts of money will be given to the states. There are 50 states, and they could have slightly different systems and rules for health insurance. A lot of experts say, wow, how does that protect consumers? It's going to cause just more confusion, and that's why Trump's critics say what's really on his mind is getting rid of a plan that's known as Obamacare, because he doesn't like it being Obamacare, the name of his predecessor. Now, as for tax reform, that's a big deal. That makes a big difference to Americans, what the tax rate is and how much is taken out of their paychecks. There seems to be progress because on Thursday, the Senate approved a budget for the coming fiscal year. And you need the budget before you then can vote on alterations in tax rates, for instance, in an easy way. And so the Republicans apparently are getting that done. But I was so struck Friday morning by remarks on Twitter by Democrats and Republicans, including U.S. senators. And Republicans said, this is great. We passed the budget. We got 51 votes. You need, that's what you need, one more than the majority. And it opens the way to the tax cuts that will revive the American economy. And Democrats said, look at this budget. It is so unfair to poor people. It cuts Medicaid and Medicare, and somehow the Republicans think they're slipping this by without folks paying attention. It's a big controversy.
But Dan, you've teed up something very interesting that I'd like to ask Tom, because Tom, you know, we're very privileged to have both of you, but Tom, you've been covering, you know, so many White Houses going way back to, you know, the 1980s.
Not Jefferson, no.
Grover Cleveland.
Grover Cleveland. So, you know, you're an extraordinary kind of resource for us. So Dan has just described Republicans saying, yippee, we're going to cut taxes. When you cut taxes, the economy booms. And Democrats saying, typical Republicans, you like to cut taxes for rich people. That's hard on poor people. Now, that piece of news could have been spoken into these microphones at any time in the last 30 years. That is how politics traditionally works in Washington. But then we have a president in the White House who some days seems to be totally on board with that very traditional conservative right-wing agenda, and he's going to cut spending on healthcare. He's going to back a Republican plan to basically make government spending less generous for the poor and the sick. But then there are other days when he wakes up and says, I'm going to make sure everyone's covered. I don't want anyone left out in the cold. This is a mean plan. I don't like this plan. Make sure I'm going to, don't worry. I'm going to make sure that the tax cuts are for the poor. I'm going to soak the rich. The rich don't pay enough tax. I'm going to do this in a bipartisan way. And sometimes we get those two President Trumps in the course of the same morning. I mean, it just depends what he's tweeting. So, Tom, if you take a step back at the relationship between this supposedly Republican president and the genuinely Republican leaders of Congress, explain to our listeners just how odd this feels in Washington, how uncertain this feels.
It's very crazy because, as you say, David, if you don't like something President Trump says, wait a day, and there's a chance that it might be 180 degrees different. We've had several examples of that recently where bipartisan members of the Senate put together a fix to the what's left of the Obamacare healthcare plan, and the president said he was all for it, and he was encouraging it a day later after he got some negative feedback from Republicans, he turned on a dime and said, no, I'm not for that. And most recently, he seems to be back to, I think this is worthwhile to proceed. I think there's some context here. One is President Trump cannot stand the Republican leaders of the Senate. He doesn't think they've done a good job. He thinks they hold their nose when dealing with him, and that they haven't been able to pass an agenda. And so there's a lot of inner tension, even though about every 3 days they all talk about how they love one another. And the other dynamic here is President Trump, and to a lesser extent the Republican-controlled Senate, is desperate for a win. Trump is a win and loss kind of guy. He's only had one victory this year, and that is getting a very conservative justice onto the U.S. Supreme Court.
And that was basically handed to him on a plate by the same Republican Senate leaders he despises.
Precisely. His biggest win was engineered by Senator Mitch McConnell, the Republican leader in the Senate. And it's an open secret in Washington that the two men cannot stand each other, more or less. And so, but the Republicans need a win, too, and they now see they need it on taxes. If they can pass a tax bill, whatever you call it, reform, whatever, the Republicans believe that will energize their base for 2018.
And, Dan, there's a really interesting—I mean, that's such a good setup of this need for a win. But of course, is one of the problems that if you're President Trump, you have two very different groups that you want to help win. So his base is increasingly, he owns the white working class, kind of factory workers, ex-factory workers, a very kind of, so they're often up for quite generous government spending on people like them, maybe not on people they dislike, but they're not looking to shrink every piece of government spending on the old or the sick, because often they're beneficiaries.
The way conventional conservatives do, yeah.
So you have Trump's base in the country is actually not a particularly small government cut spending kind of base. It's a white working class base. But then his base in Washington that can actually deliver him the votes in Congress to get anything done is much more of a conventional shrink the government, cut taxes kind of base. And is that part of the problem, that it's a very uneasy coalition and he toggles between the two?
I'm sure it is. And an unthinkable possibility is that he would decide to become a big spender and try to get Democrat votes that way. Again, I don't think he'll do it, but he's not a conventional politician. He doesn't want to be beholden to the Republican Party. He ran as a Republican. If there'd been a slot available to run as a Democrat, he might have done that. With him, it's about ego and getting things done, looking for a win. It's not about ideology.
Tom, very briefly, on this American politics segment, we saw a very rare intervention by President George W. Bush in a speech. He hasn't really spoken out much. What did he say, and what did that tell you about what a lot of kind of mainstream Republicans in their hearts think about this President Trump?
They're very concerned about President Trump. The dirty little secret in political circles is the Bush family has no use whatsoever for President Trump. There's a lot of bad blood. It goes back many years, and I think the most recent fallout was George W. Bush and his father, President George H.W. Bush, getting enraged several years ago when Donald Trump said that if Nancy Pelosi, the House Speaker at the time, wanted to introduce articles of impeachment against President George W. Bush, that would be fine with him, and they've never forgiven him. So I think the Bush criticism of Trump is heartfelt. Bush is worried about the country being pushed too far to the right, but it's was quite remarkable.
Dan, very briefly, we had a vote in the parliament in the French-speaking region of Canada, Quebec, to ban essentially anything that covers your face. But was this about things that cover your face, or was it about something else?
Well, I heard the concern expressed by some Canadian politicians, and we've heard it in some European countries as well, that it's about security, and in particular ID cards, whether it's a driver's license or some other form of identification. And if a person, let's say it's a Muslim woman, covers her face regularly, how can police, if necessary, possibly identify who that person is? So that seems, you know, practical. On the other hand, it depends how politicians put it. If in some way they are trying to insult Muslims or say in some way that immigrants have become a problem because of their habits and their family traditions, well, that smacks of intolerance. So that's the issue.
Tom, in 30 seconds, do you think we could see that kind of face veil ban in America? Would that fly?
I doubt it. It would fly probably with the 30% of the country who basically believe anything President Trump says and will support him more or less on just about anything he would want. But I don't think President Trump would propose that. I don't think that would happen in this country.
Not least because you have the Constitution protecting religious liberty. Well, that's all the time that we have. Thanks to Dan Raviv, national correspondent for Israeli-based channel i24 News, and Tom DeFrank, contributing editor to National Journal. This program was produced by Rebecca Ward. Our engineer was Justin Thwaites, and I'm David Rennie, Washington bureau chief for The Economist. Thanks for listening.